Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everyone to John Talk Radio tonight. I'm your host, John Darlington. We'll be with you till 7 o'clock tonight. This is our July the 30th, 2016 episode. My special guest tonight is Michael Morton. Michael has written a book called Getting Life. And in 1986, Michael was a supermarket manager in Texas, a husband, a father, and his life, however, took a horrific turn that same year as his wife was murdered in their bed, and he was convicted of that murder despite any evidence pointing to his guilt and tremendous evidence showing his innocence. After spending 25 years in prison for the murder of his wife, Morton was released on October 4, 2011, and officially exonerated December of 2011. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, John. It's nice to be here.
I have we were talking a little bit off mic before the show about I've done quite a few of these shows, and I've been blessed to be able to talk to a lot of people, and I really from my heart appreciate you being on the show. You have a story, Michael, that is so inspiring, and I think that in this day and age in 2016, we need to know that. We need to know that when things don't go our way, when things don't always – the pages don't turn the way we want them to, that we can make it, and that you have an incredible story. I want the people to know that the book is Getting Life, and you can pick it up on Amazon, and I'm sure every place in the bookstores and places you can get it. I highly recommend the book. Michael, I was raised, my mother was a librarian, so I was, as a method of babysitting, I had to spend a lot of time in the library, and I read, and that's one of the things that I did. And I've read a lot of books, and your book is really well written. It's a page turner. One of the things I always have a little trouble with, Michael, in doing these interviews is I want people to read your book, but we're going to talk about it. So I want them to understand that even though your life is, you know, you've been on 60 Minutes, you've been on different news shows, your life is out there, but it's still, when you read the book, you get that personal touch of your life that no one else can give but you. My first question, Michael, is, and we got a lot to talk about, but was it difficult for you to decide to write a book that was first person from your perspective? And was that a difficult task for you to do?
Well, yes, no. It's kind of fun.
You're cutting out a little bit.
Sorry. Let me take my phone off the speaker just a minute.
Okay.
Okay. How's that, John?
Yeah, that's much better. Thank you.
Okay. Well, what I was going to say was when I started writing at first, and I did this while I was inside because I kept a journal and I gave a – I tried my hand at some short stories and a couple novels, but my point is that some people will call it the first person narrative a crutch because you can be a medium, you can get inside somebody's head a lot easier. And so I tried to avoid that after I started writing a while. But when you deal with memoir, which the publishers wanted, you have to go back to that. So it's a little bit of a challenge in that regard, but easy because, you know, I couldn't make anything up. It just quite happened. The real challenge in writing something like this is what you leave out, because you have to leave out certain things. You can't put everything in there. And like, this interview is going to last as long as it lasts, but there's a ton of stuff we can't talk about because there just isn't time.
Correct. Was it difficult to – and I think I know the answer to this, but when you're writing this, and I've talked to other people, Michael, that have written about – very incredibly difficult times in their lives, and there is never anyone that has gone through anything that would be as difficult as this. But when you're going through it, when you're reliving it, like you're going to do tonight, and when you're reliving it in the book, how does that feel? What is that emotion when you have to go back and relive that day in 1986?
Well, I think it's not unlike when I give the speeches that I give around the country. And I, with a little bit of a and a humor, I try to say that I'm, you know, probably saving on the shrink bills, because there's this cathartic aspect to it. You're going again and again and again. You're kind of working through it. And I think it has added a little bit of adjustment or sanity or groundedness for myself to tell it. But try to be defensive. You know, the most important question is why. You know, why, you know, why am I doing this? Why isn't my life comfortable? And that's one of the things I've gotten having to retell this, having to, is it get a better handle on it and answer those questions about why.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because that's something that always happens. You know, people ask when something terrible happens to people, why does that happen? And, you know, the old cliche, Michael, you know, bad things happen to good people. And when that happens, but when this happened to you, things were moving so quickly, and I'm sure that you were trying to figure out why this happened, and then why it seemed like the people that should have been helping you, and I'm talking about the prosecution, or actually not the prosecutors, but the government, the sheriff, the people that you look for guidance and you trust. I mean, that's how we're raised. Hopefully I'm saying this correctly, but to trust the police and to trust the sheriff and to trust these people. And when things seem to be going the opposite direction, that would be incredibly frustrating. And that would be the question that you'd want to know why. And you asked that, you know, you brought that up in the book. Why are they doing this to me? You know, and I think that that is one of the things that, you know, that has to be a part of your nature, a part of Michael Morton's nature to know, you know, because when things start happening, you want to know why this is happening. Now, when people read the book, and I want them to understand that, you know, it's a you get into pretty good detail in the book, and you talk about things that happened to you that it's almost like, you know, like a movie or something. Did it seem real to you when it was going on, Michael, or did it have sort of a surreal feel to it at times?
Well, I think like any unique first-time experience, but especially this one, because it was so horrific, it was real Kafka-esque. It was definitely happening. I mean, it was tangible. It was right in front of me, and I could sense it by everything that I had. But it was so bizarre. Nothing seemed to. Things weren't working the way they were supposed to.
Right, and that's one of the interesting things that I think when this is all happening to you now, for people that are listening in and don't know that much about the case, you came home from work, or you went to work, and your wife was brutally murdered, and you were. And the sheriff immediately, I think was it Sheriff Boutwell, is that correct?
It is.
Yep. Immediately started building a case against you. Now, when this is all going on, and this is a question I have, that how you reacted to this. You're going through one of the most terrific, horrendous things that can ever happen to you. But you have to be on your toes, and you have to be at your best wits. But isn't that kind of impossible when something that terrible is happening to you, to be able to combat what they're coming at you? Does that make sense? I mean, you have to be able to do that, but that's got to be an almost impossible thing to do. How did you feel when you knew?
You want to make sense. You know,
Yeah, you're still cutting out. I can't hear you.
Yeah, you're trying to.
Yeah, I'm having trouble hearing you, Michael. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine.
Good.
Can you hear me okay? Are we okay now?
It's better. It's just a little. If you could speak up a little bit, I can. I think it's in the phone line, but I'm not exactly sure. My guess is
back.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, and for people who are listening, my guess is Michael Morton, and the book is Getting Life, and it's Innocent Man's 25-Year Journey from Prison to Peace. Now, some of the things that I know that's happened through this, and you were able to have an attitude, Michael, that in going through this, you say in your book that you didn't want revenge, and I think that is so incredible. How did you come to that point? Because there had to be, I think it would have happened to me, I'm not sure how I would handle that. Where did Michael Morton come up to a point where he was thinking, okay, I want justice and I want peace and I want that for this, I'm not interested in revenge or any payback. Talk us through that a little bit.
Okay. For a long, long time, for many, many years, I was very, very angry after all of the failed appeals, the death of my family. It was like couldn't attend it. Many things bad had happened. And not to put find a point on it, but I spent years and years plotting to kill the people in the carceral. I mean, the irony wasn't lost on me that I was something I hadn't done, killing somebody that I hadn't killed. And I was sitting in there planning to kill these people who had put me there. And I was very angry. I was very bitter. And I wanted some flesh. I wanted some payback. I wanted to balance the books. And lots of bad things had happened to me over the years. Probably the worst was my son being born with a congenital heart defect. Helpless. I couldn't help my son, and that was bad. And my wife's murder was obviously horrific. My murder trial and conviction, all these things, plus just the day-to-day reality. But none of these things had broken me. I had never hit rock bottom. I'd always toughed it out. I was always a tough guy. I got by in there because I put this shell around myself. I became real hard-hearted. And at the same time, I was always also looking for my son. He was my light at the end of the tunnel. My goal, the reason I didn't get up, well, the reason I got out of bed every morning, I didn't hang myself or commit suicide or try to end it all. But my dream was to get out somehow someday and reconnect with my son. And
right.
that was what kept going. Well, it was 2001, after I'd been inside for 14 years, I got a piece of mail about my son. And I had lost almost everything up to that point. And I got this letter about my son, and I found out that he was turning 18 that year and was going to legally change his name. He was going to be adopted by people raising him, and I was going to officially and legally lose my son. And for whatever reason, whether that was a cumulative thing or just the very worst thing that happened, I can't tell you. But I do know that went broke. And I did something very uncharacteristic for me back then, is I had nowhere to go and no idea what was going on. I quite literally cried out, God help. And I heard absolutely nothing, got nothing at all. And be completely honest about it, trajectory of my life, things have been happening, that's kind of what I expected, you know, nothing. And I sort of chewed on that and settled in bitterness until about a week later. And it was about a week later, and it was an incredibly boring, special day in the penitentiary. It was gray. Eating anything unusual in the head. I didn't take any weird medication. Nothing happened unusual. It was very, very, very average.
Right.
That was the end of the day. And I was in my bunk. I was on the top bunk. My apartment was on the bottom. Sleep late at night and go to bed. I had gone through this routine literally thousands of times before, and every indicator was I was going to do this again more thousands of times. My idea was turn off the lamp inside my bunk, put on my radio headphones on the radio, go down the dial, call it a night, and maybe go, don't set the alarm. And I did that, and I picked up a radio station out of Houston. I had a classic station, and I annotated some woman playing the harp. I have no idea if it was a man or a woman, but my mind, it was a woman playing harp. Harp music is rather unusual, and I sat with a little novelty good for a moment. Then, without any preamble or warning or hint of what would happen, I immediately found myself bathed in golden light. And
wow.
There's a roaring ears, and I can't explain it. I can't use the proper words, but all I could see was the golden light. And I couldn't hear anything else but the roaring, and I felt wonderful. I felt if I don't know if I really was, but I felt as if I might have been floating above my bunk. I felt euphoric. I felt calm. I decided I was bouncing all over the place emotionally, but I mean, all those things was insane. I knew without a doubt that I was in the presence of God. And
right.
It was self-evident. I didn't need any explanation. It was very, very clear. But more powerful than that, and much, much more powerful than that, I felt His love aimed at me. Not all mankind, which is not probably true, but it was aimed right at me. That was a game changer. I mean, it overpowered life. Oh, my God. A few other things are relevant to our fear, but a short time after that, I heard my alarm going off, and I instinctively reached over and turned it off besides my bunk. It was morning, time to get up. And I had no sense of time having passed, but I looked over and my radio was turned off, my headphones were hanging on the hook, I had no memory of that. The light was off, I had no memory of turning it off. If it happened that way, then my bunk, whoa, what was fun? I knew what it was. It was the presence of God, but why? I was curious, why did that happen? Why did I sense that light in his presence, and why was that different? I didn't know, because I was nobody. I spent months doing, thinking about it, talking, reading, even praying about it. Like, what's this about? And after I reached a point where I embraced that notion of Occam's razor. And Occam's razor is just a philosophical idea that simplest explanation until proven wrong probably the best one. The way that applied to me, what made sense about this was I realized the only thing that had happened, I had asked God, help me, show me something, I got nothing here. And I'd received. And I knew that this was genuine. I knew that it was real. I knew it wasn't some fake, because I was different. The things that I had hated in the past, I now crave. And things that I had craved in the past, I now despise. And I wanted to be better. I wanted to be right. And
wow.
This was kind of like waking up one morning and just really craving a steaming bowl of Brussels sprouts. You know, this wasn't rational. It was completely counterintuitive. Why would you wake up one morning after the experience? What did you change on the end? The biggie was that really it actually, I'm not accustomed to supernatural experience. I'm not a sight patient. This actually changed my heart. But this isn't one of those, you know, hallelujah, brother, stories like in the New Testament where I saw the light, brother, and I got out of prison. No, no, no. I was inside for a decade.
Yep.
But I was different.
I was just going to say that when I was reading the book, I'm a man of faith, and I sometimes think about, you know, what would happen to me if something happened. And I think it's so incredible when you're talking about that, because you reached out to God and you prayed to God, but you didn't get an instant response. And I think that happens a lot. You know, people think, well, you know, this didn't happen. And you say in the book, I believe you talk about God's time and not isn't our time. Is that correct? His timetable?
Yeah, actually some of the best advice I ever received with my sister, Vicky. She came to visit me, and I was, you know, open and complaining about, you know, a lot. And she, you know, basically put her hand on mine and said, you know, it's not on your time schedule, you know. I said, oh, okay, yeah, okay, good. And it only makes sense in hindsight. And great.
Well, you were definitely in a situation to try. You had every – I guess this might sound weird, but you had almost every reason to doubt. I mean, like you said, your sons had the illness. You lost your wife. I mean, the people that were supposed to be helping you were against you. It just seemed like you had every reason, logical reason, to say, you know, this – everything's against me. And I think it's so incredible because in your life, Michael – you were able to get an answer, and you knew it wasn't like words, but you knew, you felt that it was that strength that you were looking for. Is that correct?
Yeah, in a way, it was his strength. It was weird. It's so weird. I apologize up front. I asked, you know, cut the little back. You know, I want to say the right thing. I want to describe it. But words just don't cut it. They don't measure up. They're feeble, weak, and inappropriate. But words all I have. That was one of the challenges of writing this book or telling anybody about this experience. It's difficult because words don't do it. You try to talk about, you know, what is blue like? It's very, very difficult.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I think it's one of those things where it's like, you know, it happened. It's like getting hit by a Mack truck. You know, it happened. It's just hard to describe to somebody. And it's like, it's incredible. Now, at that point, when you had that experience and you felt God's presence and you felt like, okay, I'm not alone. And that had to make you feel, that had would be the thing that would make me feel comfort would be the fact that you knew you weren't alone. Now you had your mother and father. You talked about your sister. One of the things that I think in the book that stood out to me, Michael, that I think was really awesome was the typewriter. Would you like to talk to the people about your typewriter and how it changed Michael Morton?
Oh gosh. Yeah. Early on in my incarceration, I was receiving a little bit of money each month. My parents sent me, you know, I bankrupt myself against charges. My parents bankrupt themselves, you know, paying for attorneys and legal fees and things. And so I don't come from money. But my parents were sending me a small amount of money every month. And I realized that if I saved a little bit of aside, in about a year and a half, I could probably afford one of these plastic penitentiary typewriters. Vintage typewriter. They only sell certain types of typewriters inside there because it's very. Oh, no, who's making typewriters these days? The world's going digital, but some companies still make, I guess, for the third world or whatever, and the penitentiary as well. And so, I let my parents know that, you know, this is what I was doing. I wasn't just, you know, frivolously rolling a little bit of money they were giving me away. I was trying to be very frugal with it. Well, mother shared that story with her Sunday school class, and one Christmas I got barred from her Sunday school class, and in my mind it was a bunch of sweet little white-haired ladies doing little bakes. They raised some money and they took, you know, they passed, they got cleaned up. They just started so kind of so sweet, and they threw in a little 50 or 100 bucks extra to, you know, go into it or whatnot. And that typewriter was a wonderful, wonderful gift. But it also opened doors to me. I was using it for my legal work, but I was also starting to write short stories because I went back to college, but also, you know, a novel. And one of the blessings, versus how do I look at it, of having to write this book when I had over 1,000-page journal that I kept while I was inside. And there is just a ton of stuff to draw on. And probably the hardest part of the book was what do you leave out, what do you put in? But that typewriter was like a little escape hatch. In fact, while I was in one of my dorms, everybody knew not to bother me if I put on I had a little white baseball cap. And if I had that baseball cap on, guys knew, don't bug me, he's writing. You know, it was kind of a neat thing. You know, when I took the cap off, someone could come talk to me. But if I had a hat on, I was writing. No,
that's a good idea.
It worked.
I like
it worked
that
really well.
Yeah. Now, was there any kind of did the prison check what you were writing, or did you have freedom to write whatever you wanted?
Well, you can write anything you want, but anything that you send out, and I was sending out stacks, or, you know, of this journal to a friend of mine, and a guy named Jack Anderson. I mean, I wouldn't have had that journal if he hadn't kept it. He kept it through moves and houses and marriages and new houses. Bless his heart, he hung on to that thing for 20-some years as it grew.
Wow.
But, you know, the penitentiary, they will scanning. They'll check things that you're sending out, and they'll check the mail coming in, your job. Because you can imagine the penitentiary, the things that might come in if they didn't check them.
Right.
I had to be sometimes I wrote in a little bit of code. You know, I knew what it meant, but I didn't know what.
I still having a little trouble hearing you, but I'll go ahead and ask another question. I'm not sure if you're still there.
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. How it's just kind of cutting in and out. What was the how important was it for you to write creatively when you were there, because this is one of the things, a lot of the shows I do, Michael, are you know, around art and music and things like that, and how that people, once they start creating things and writing and making, like you said, you were writing the short stories and novels and things like that. How did that make you feel? I mean, did that give you a relief while you were doing that?
It was something of a survival technique, I think, and in hindsight, because the penitentiary is, it's a very, very harsh environment, very, very brutal, but also mind-numbingly boring. And it, you know what's going to happen, it's just the same thing. It's Groundhog Day from hell, you know, the old movie,
yep.
Groundhog Day.
Right.
And so how you decide to spend your time can mean the difference in, you know, thriving or some vibrancy, or, you know, your brain turned to mush. You just sit there and watch basketball all day long, or, you know, some soap opera day after day after day. So having some kind of productive, creative, something you can do really, really, it helped me stay sharp, it helped me stay alive, and it helped me have some kind of focus and a purpose. Everybody needs something. It was a great lesson I learned very early on. When I went to church, my first year, I met a guy who'd already been there 20 years. And our schedules just happened to sort of coincide, and we started working out together. And one day, one of the guys on the cell block hanged himself. I mean, a suicide, he was dead. It was the talk of the cell block. I mentioned it, and we talked about the guy. His name was Lonnie. And I said, man, Lonnie, you ever seen that before? And he said, oh, yeah. He'd seen a lot of it over his life. He said, everybody needs something to look forward to, no matter what it is. He said, some guys look forward to rebuilding an old house, or maybe building an old car, or trying to rebuild an old marriage, some relationship.
Right.
Turned to me and he said, you got your son. And it kind of surprised me because he already spotted that my focus, my son. And writing was just one of those things that, you know, I had to focus on. You can't, you know, do 24/7 or your son's not there. But you need something to look forward to, something to do. Writing helped me. My mind started to get me busy. And it kept me from down to some people. And you can sort of say my son saved me in a way.
And people need to, when you read Michael's book, you're going to see the ups and downs with your son, Eric, and how that incredible life, and from what I understand, you know, I'll let people read it, but things worked out pretty good at the end. And that's always incredible. I mean, that's the thing that one of the things, Michael, I like doing these shows is if I can help people, direct them to people like you and the other people I've talked to let them know that no matter what, how dark it gets and how rough it gets, but there's hope. And your son gave you that, so that you could know that, you know, no matter what it seemed like with your relationship, that you had that hope that it was going to get back together. And you really did. And I think that's awesome. Guess is Michael Morton.
Yeah, it was one of my answered prayers. It really was.
Yeah, and that's just amazing to me. I think it's so incredible that, you know, that people can, that can, and this is happening quite a bit. And one of the things we're going to come, when we come back, we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk to Michael, and we're going to talk about what happened, how the Innocence Project stepped in and helped, how that things turned around, how that you got freedom. It's like, I couldn't turn the pages fast enough. It was like, I just wanted to know. I mean, I knew basically what happened, but it's just incredible. So we'll be right back. The music in today's show, the first song we heard today was Jeff Clark, and he's an Austin, Texas native, and that was We Can Make It. And we're going to hear a song now from a band, Active Heat, and we'll be right back after this, and we'll continue our conversation with Michael Morton. And we're back on John Talk Radio. It's our July the 30th, 2016 episode. My guest is Michael Morton. Michael is the author of Getting Life, An Innocent Man's 25-Year Journey from Prison to Peace. So, Michael, let's talk about the Innocence Project and how that – I know Barry Scheck was involved and how that turned your case around. It would seem to me like you were in a place where it would be easy to give up, and you were trusting and hoping that other people were working on it. I know your defense team was doing what they could. Talk about how that the Innocence Project stepped in and how things started to change.
Sure. The Innocence Project is a nonprofit. And shortly after the OJ trial, Barry Scheck got a lot of national publicity and awareness about his project. He and Peter Neufeld started it together. They're co-founders. And my mother, my aunt, my sister, some friends, they sent letters of support asking for help for me. But the biggie was one of my lawyers at trial, I had two attorneys representing me. One of them was actually a friend of Barry Scheck's. I mean, my attorney, Bill Allison, would go up to New York once a year and be a guest lecturer at the law school up there where Barry is, and their wives know each other, they're friends, and my lawyer, Bill, offered my case to Barry, would you please take this? Barry said, sure, yeah, no problem. And Bill tells me, and I'm thrilled to death because, hey, a friend of Barry Scheck is giving him a case and accepting it, so I'm in. And I'm very thrilled about that, but there's no special interest. My file had to go into the bottom of the stack with all those hundred files, slowly work its way up to the top of the stack. They have quite a process where they try to thin out the herd because, they have as great as they are, they have limited resources, and they can't help everybody. Not everybody has the evidence. Not everybody has preserved records. Sometimes there's just not any DNA in your case. Sometimes they just can't help you, no matter how worthy you are, no matter how worthy your cause. But my case slowly worked the way up to the top until they started doing things on my case. And one of the things that they did is they always want to have a lawyer from the state where you are, a registered lawyer in that state, also representing you, working with them. And they ran across a guy named John Raley out of Houston, Texas. Now, John Raley is a great guy, but he is a civil attorney. He's never done a criminal case in his life. But he has some medical expertise and some medical issues. So he came on just to help out with an attorney record, but he was just a B-teamer. He wasn't. But he became more and more involved and more dedicated. And his talent really blossomed and helped me a lot. And Nina Morrison was staff attorney with the Innocence Project. And so Nina Morrison and John Bailey were the two main weightlifters on my side. They did all everything. And it was just amazing the work they did. Never giving up, working and working and fighting and fighting. It took them years just to get a hearing. County where I'm from, they fought every single request. The Innocence Project was offering to test some of the evidence in my case, so they were just wanting permission. They wanting access. Cost the state nothing. They were going to pay for everything, but the prosecutors in my case fought and fought. In fact, the prosecutor actually took my case to court. While I was inside, this guy became a judge, Ken Anderson, and right. A new prosecutor came in his place, his old assistant, John Bradley, and he fought for years and years. There was a point where we were getting a little bit of access, but all the tests were coming back either inconclusive or negative, weren't helping at all. And it was very clear that our options were becoming fewer and fewer. And I actually sent a letter to the Innocence Project saying that, they'd been so great to me. They'd given me hope and they'd tried so hard. But I could see that there was possible point where there weren't going to be any more options. And I was building my deck. You know, sometimes, no matter how much you want it, there just isn't anything there. But they never did. In fact, sound like you have a question?
No, go ahead. That's great. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, there was this one thing that they did that I wasn't aware of, and any good lawyer or any good legal team will always have a plan B. Because nobody knows what a DNA test is going to reveal. Until you run it, you don't know what it's going to say. I mean, so their plan D was to file a Texas Open Records request. The Texas Open Records Act is basically like a Freedom of Information thing at the federal level. And they requested the files from the prosecutor and the files from the sheriff back in 1986 and 87. And so we're already in the 21st century by now, and so it was granted. And those files were sent to the offices, or at least copies of the files were sent to the offices of the Innocence Project in New York. And they were quite literally up against the wall in a corner. And they said, oh, no, you intern, Rachel, go and dig in that file and see if there's anything, because we're real busy over here with this DNA stuff. See if there's anything of relevance over there. And I didn't find out about this until just before I got out.
Wow.
But intern Rachel found these things in the prosecutor's and the sheriff's file. The first thing she found was a check that had been cashed after my wife's death. Apparently, after her death, and the check. And we confiscate the card, we'll get to you and give you the information about everything, because you can't come down here. But the Williamson County people never followed up. And they also found some police reports where neighbors, right after the murder, the investigation, the neighbors had told the investigators that they had seen a van pull up behind our house a couple times, and the guy would get out and go into the wooded area and walk up the fence, kind of, you know, casing our house before we entered it. But the kicker was, none of that stuff was ever revealed when requests were made for information. And the biggest, most horrific thing that they found in there was what John Rady termed the monster transcripts. And the sheriff's office had a transcript of a telephone conversation between my mother-in-law and the chief investigator. And in it, she told him about a conversation she had with my son, my three-year-old son, had actually witnessed the murder. And for whatever reason, he told only his grandmother and no one else. In fact, I had taken him to a string of child psychologists because everybody was very concerned about my son, because he was, 3-year-old son was in the house when my wife was killed. And we were terrified that it might have happened to him or he might have seen something. But the consensus from the shrinks was that, no, he hadn't, apparently nothing bad had happened to him, hadn't seen anything, but he was just suffering from, you know, separation anxiety, blah, blah, blah. But we found transcripts in the sheriff's file that he had seen, that he had witnessed the murder. And
wow,
that extra evidence, after including the DNA stuff that finally was revealed, the bandana that my brother-in-law behind our house, just outside the fence in a construction site, and the police had missed it. And he picked up, put it in a bag, and delivered to gave it to the police. And in years, it finally got asked, okay, let's test. And sure enough, and the man's DNA commingled with the DNA. And I heard this in June of 2011. And it wasn't until, I believe it was August. In fact, it was my birthday. I got the news that a man's DNA, a guy named Mark Norwood, and he had a long criminal history, and he had died in California, and he was living in Austin at the time, and so that put him at the crime scene. But it wasn't until they discovered this guy's DNA at another murder scene. And that's what made things start really falling in place. That's what got me out. They finally made a deal.
The book is Getting Life, and I guess is Michael Morton. And I want everyone that's listening, we're having a little trouble with you breaking up, Michael, and I'm sorry about that. But the story is incredible. What Michael was talking about with the DNA evidence and the things that happened, good things did come out, and the Michael Morton Act was put into in Texas. And talk about that a little bit, because that I think it was Bill 1611, and it was to help with discovery of evidence. And one of the things that when I read this, Michael, and I read about it and I hear it from you, is that we started off our conversation with you wanted to know why this was happening to you and all these things were happening. And to me, the question would be, why were the prosecutors, why were they working so hard, and why were they not looking at all the evidence? And that's one of the things that's come out of this, is that Michael Morton Act and the fact that there has to be open discovery. If the prosecution has information, they have to be able to share that with the defense teams. People may not know all of that. And I'm not sure, I know this is in Texas. If you could talk a little bit about that, Michael, and how that has come forth to help, because I think one of the things that always bothers me is the fact that when people, you know, get in trouble and they get a defense team, sometimes they can't afford good lawyers, and they get court-appointed people, and things just don't go the way that they should. And there's not a real cut-and-dried way to fight that. Talk about that with the open disclosure and what has happened and the act that the Texas has taken, and how you feel about that, because that's got to make you feel pretty good.
Yeah. This has been one of the very surprising, what I call the hand of God things, where something I never dreamed past. And people have been working in this field for years. You know, I'm flavor of the month. I just show up in the scene and things start happening. The way things used to be was, well, I tell you what, I think it was 1963 with Brady versus Maryland. From then on, everybody in the United States was supposed to, if you're a prosecutor and you're trying to prosecute some citizen of some crime, according to Brady versus Maryland, there's anything called, if there's any evidence that's exculpatory, in other words, any evidence that makes the defense good, the state is supposed to provide it to show them, look, you know, we've also got this evidence here. Well, that's only worked if you've got a very good prosecutor. The way it used to work, it was like playing cards, and you're playing for money. The prosecutor is beating the cards. But the prosecutor is also looking at the cards before he lets you have it and say, well, I don't think I'll let you have that card, but I'll let you have the other card.
That's a great example.
Yeah, there was an incredible motive for the prosecution to withhold evidence. And that's no longer the case. I'm not a lawyer, but I've been told that Texas now has the most robust and powerful discovery rules in the nation. All it says is that the prosecutors will have an open file, that when they have a case and they bring a case against the citizen, they will say, look, here's the evidence we have against you, good and bad, and we think it's enough to nail you or not. And you have to look at it, your attorney. And obviously, they're working things out, but I mean, that's the only way that you can do that and be fair about it. I mean, you said something earlier about some guys, you know, they just have a, you know, court appointed. You don't have the best lawyers in the world. I had a really good lawyer. I spent everything I had. I bought or rented the best attorneys I could get, and they did a superb job. But because they had an unscrupulous prosecutor, they couldn't get at what they needed to get at. And now now that we have that, can't tell you how many prosecutors I've talked to and defense attorneys I've talked to that say it's so much easier now. Some of the prosecutors don't really like it at first because you're in your discrimination, you're taking some of the power away. Nobody wants to be told how to do the job when they're good at it. If you're a chef or a carpenter or a radio host, you know how to do your job. You don't want somebody looking over your shoulder trying to do it. But now I've tried to prosecutors tell me that this actually makes their cases stronger. Because, and it almost makes them appeal-proof when it comes to discovery. That's a good thing for everybody. You know, you can't. I can't get my time back. I did all of this stuff at the state legislature. I lobbied them with some help from a lobbyist named Thomas Ratliff. I lobbied a lot of senators and representatives. And the way it ended up working out is the bill passed both houses of the state legislature unanimously.
Wow, that's awesome.
And I think voted against it and pulled it up that year as the very first bill to sign. And that was a very gratifying moment because whether you're a very left liberal Democrat or a very far right Republican, I've been amazed if you want the same thing. Nobody wants to put the wrong people in jail. In fact, both sides of the political spectrum want to do the same thing. They may be wanting to do it for very different reasons, but I've learned that both sides of the political spectrum want the same thing in this particular field of criminal justice. And it's been very reassuring. It's very gratifying. And the main thing is, you see, I don't want what happened to me to happen to you. And Bill 1611 by Morton Act, that goes a good way towards community. That's a good thing.
Now, Michael, we just have a short amount of time left, and I just want to thank you so much. It's just great meeting you and talking to you, and I think it's – Michael's book is Getting Life, and I highly recommend it. I'm telling a lot of people about it. You did say something very important. What happened to you, you don't want to happen to other people. But it does happen to other people. And I've interviewed other folks that have been through these kind of situations and or family members. What are some of the things that you tell folks? I know you speak around the country and you try to help people that this doesn't happen to them. What are the things in a nutshell, Michael, that you tell people that are in that situation you were in, some of the things that they can do to help them to get the best
sure
help they possibly can?
You know, I've had a lot of people happen to me, and I've met folks, and I'm telling you that if you've had a horrible financial, you've never had a terrible medical emergency in your life, this or a bankruptcy or a marital infidelity, your life hasn't been bloated. Everybody has something really horrific happen to them sooner or later. And what I tell people, no matter how horrible it is, look, I can get through what happened to me. It happened to you. And you can do it with three simple little things that I learned and have got me through all of it and more. First one is I know that God is sick. Three. Number two, He's wise, a lot smarter than I am. Number three, love. You can embrace and internalize those three things. You can get through it. Nobody.
Well, I really appreciate you, Michael, taking your time tonight to be on the show. And I would love to have you on again. I would like for people to understand that we've talked a lot about Michael's case, but there is so much in this book that you're going to understand and learn about what can happen to an individual and how you can take something that can be so horrific and turn it around and make it something that is helping other people. Michael, thank you so much for being on the show. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
I think that about covered it there. With, you know, you can get through anything. I mean, it may not be the horrible thing like I went through, but as Viktor Frankl wrote, your personal crisis, whatever it is the most important one. What's happening to you is the most important thing to you. And if I can get through mine, you can get through you. I think it's been good.
Yeah, and I really appreciate it, Michael. And we'll stay in touch. And what's the website that people can go to? I believe it's michael-morton.com. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, and we've just updated it. We're about to, go live with it in about a week or so, but we've got the old version still up. It's michael-morton.com. It's real simple.
Well, Michael, thank you so much, and I wish the best for you. And we will stay in touch, and thank you so much. And I want to thank everybody for supporting independent radio and John Talk Radio through the years, and we really appreciate it. And everybody have a great evening. Michael, we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye, John.
Bye.
It's safe to say that sundown means the day is through, and cools a single blade of leaves and washes them with dew. It's safe to say I've known you. If today my life falls through, and it's safe to say I love you, 'cause girl, you know I do. I've heard the wildest stories, and I've heard that rain must fall, and when everything's forgotten, there ain't nothing left at all. My mind will still remember the times when we were two, and I'll think about